In other words, this period of your 3 years as Reeve of Burnaby was in many ways a re-entry into active political life, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Practically, is the word.
Yeah.
That's the only practical experience I had. The rest was just having a good time going after the other fellows. You know? Well, in 1916, that goes back a long way.
Yeah.
And we got up to London, I think it was London. Have a meeting there, and the old chap was named Stewart, a liberal. Not a bad old fellow, but he had lost his sense of humor, if he ever had it. He was that type. So he blew for a while. We still on the docks, and I got a meeting going on the dockside, and he got kind of mad. And he said, "I know who's behind Pritchard. I know why he's running in this constituency. The Conservative Party that's behind him." That's the usual stuff. I said, "You're right, Huey, and a heck of a long way behind him." So, when I met him again, was in Powell River, and my brother was playing a clarinet in the Powell River band then, and they had the band, and they gave me 25 minutes on the platform, which was quite a slice for me. So I put down my brass watch along with the two other watches, gold watches there, and I said to the chairman, "Don't see they don't get mixed." And I set off. Well, the chairman rapped it. He said, "Your time is up. Your time is up." And I kept on going. And then he got louder and louder. "Your time is up," I said. And I pointed at the crowd. "My time is up." And I said, "You stand for democracy?" The crowd said, "Yes, let's put it to the meeting. All in favor that I continue, say aye." "Aye!" "Contrary?" But shut up. So I went on for another 20 minutes. Because, after all, he didn't have anything to say. And then I went on. His speech came on, they started to walk out. And they faded away. And even the band that had been paid there to play, it started to wander off, you know. And the tail end of the band, of course, is a drummer going out through the door, and I go, "Mr. Chairman, I can see that the only thing that you and Stuart can beat has already gone out, and I'll follow the drum." And out I went. I was last happy. Oh, in Cumberland.
That was 1916 you're talking about now.
1916,
this was.
16, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
that was some election. That was the election where they voted for the ladies, provincially, and against booze. They brought in the ladies and prohibited booze in this province. And look at it now. Gosh, the beer parlors, of course, are much more beautiful and sensible than dives. You can see there's a high class in the States.
Mr. Pritchard, were you religious during that period? Were you religious?
No, you couldn't say that. No,
you had no religious affiliation?
Not then, no. I was brought up in a religious atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
In fact, strictly, very strict, if you know. You couldn't get any stricter.
What's that? Presbyterian?
Chapel or church?
You were still far to the right, or to the left.
Yeah.
I wasn't a Jehovah's Witness. They weren't in existence then. No, Plymouth Brethren. Of the strictest. Now, you know, we come across. I don't bother about it.
Uh-huh.
You know. This girl's father was a friend of mine for 40 years. He knew what I was, and I knew what he was. But we had other things to talk about, we had other things to do, and we had other interests. He couldn't bother me about my religion, and I didn't bother him about his. We didn't bother about it. But I was interested in their organization of the postal workers. And he was a postal worker. He became a postal worker. I helped organize them. And there's a man in San Jose that Mary knows that writes to me every Christmas and has been writing to me since concerning Nixon. And he was one of these boys in the Postal Service.
Tell us a little bit more about the organization of the postal workers. Where did you organize them? In Vancouver?
But I was behind the scenes. I was behind the scenes. Because of the question of the Trades and Labor Council.
Yeah.
What I did was quietly on the outside. It was the committee that helped. And what happened, as I remember, they organized the letter carriers.
Was there a National Postal Workers Union?
No. They were organizing the letter carriers union. And I think at that time I suggested it. Hold it. Go a little further. Postal workers were inside too. They got a postal workers union. That was the first step. Then it moved on to civil servants went to work. Immigration officers and customs. They were separate. There's a civil service federation, I think, that covers the whole works now. And you can say this about postal employees and the postal service in Canada. The employees are, I think, much better paid. They don't work on Saturday. They don't deliver mail on Saturday. And as far as I'm concerned, they haven't been delivering any day, really. But you have a good postal service, by and large.
So did you succeed in organizing the postal workers then?
They succeeded. I wasn't in that picture too much, but it's there. And that's why these fellows, I guess some of them, I don't know, I forget some of the names, Mary, they always look to me, so they come to me.
Did you organize any other unions?
The International Timber Workers here.
International Timber Workers?
Yeah.
Is that part of the AFL?
It was then.
And I guess it became part of the...
I don't know what it became. I think it probably became non-extra. And something else took its place. Now, I don't know, the timber workers here, they belong to the Canadian, isn't it? Congress?
Canadian Labour Congress.
Yeah. The IWA.
The IWA.
That is International...
International Woodworkers Association.
That covers the loggers at...
That covers the loggers and everything, yes.
Oh.
There used to be an organization called the Lumber and Sawmill Workers.
Yes.
And then there was the IWA.
Yes.
And now there's just the one union.
Well, we tried to organize there the one mill. I was working there at the time. The first obstacle you reach is, all right, if you fellas down there want to organize, the sawyers and pilots will have their own organization. I had to battle against that.
So you organized on an industrial line?
Yes, just then. And then, of course, I left the mill because it closed down when we started to move, and I had to get a job, so I went to the waterfront. I didn't organize that. It was there when I joined.
You had been a member of that organization?
Longshoremen?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I was in the auxiliary first and was president of the auxiliary. That was divided. They weren't divided. The dock workers against ship workers.
Oh, yeah.
Then it was mother. Now I became president of the union itself. And I came back from Winnipeg in the spring of 1921. I had no job here for me. So I picked up my ticket in the ILA and went back on the waterfront again. And stepped into the strike of 1922. Now, you could go through the Winnipeg experience and go to jail and then become a target. And I was a target for these employers. In fact, part of their propaganda was, some of these men have recently been in jail. Some of these men, and I was the only one from Vancouver. The same stuff they've got on the aliens.
So, when you organized the Longshoremen's Union after leaving the timber workers,
No, I didn't organize the Longshoremen's Union.
No, that's right. They were in existence.
Yeah. They sprang up in 1912.
Yeah, and you joined them.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you become active in them?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
Were you a delegate?
How do you think I would have been elected president?
You were elected president in 1919. But I'm talking now about 1930. It must be both.
No,
I'm talking about 1922.
Oh, I
see. He meant to the Dragon
22.
How about telling us about that?
Well, how I got out of the Longshoremen's Union, how I got off the waterfront, was that I was barred. Top man on the blacklist. Maybe that's why I ran for council in Burnaby. I had nothing else to do. Huh?
Well, there are not.
There's a gap there.
Well, to come back now to your have been Reeve, and you're not now no longer Reeve, but you are active politically. You have begun to become active politically again. What kind of political activity were you in after you left the Reeveship?
Well, you've already got that. In the Reconstruction Society, lived a short time and then became dispersed, as it were, or divided into CCF clubs. They grew up without anybody organizing them all over the place.
But didn't that Reconstruction Party reappear in 1937 as the constructive?
No.
The constructionist?
No, no. No, that's an entirely different group.
Not the same group?
No. They became CCF clubs.
Yes.
Because there was a great interest then in the idea, the CCF, what came out of Regina. Had there not been CCF clubs, the only section from British Columbia would have been that remnant of the Socialist Party. And it was small. And as you ought to know now, somewhat addicted to rigidity and dogma, which I resent. And that's, I guess, why I wasn't in with them.
So you joined the CCF because you thought it was stronger and less dogmatic.
Well, I thought it would go somewhere and do something.
Yeah.
I was mistaken. Movements don't go in always where you expect them to. They take their own course.
But at that time, shortly after the formation of the CCF, and you became president of the BC CCF Club.
I know you're getting it mixed, Norman. I was never president of CCF Clubs. I was only president of a short-lived organization called the Reconstruction Society. There were teachers and professors and whatnot composed it. And they dragged me in to become chairman.
That 32?
No.
1931?
32? This would be 1930 and 1933. Yeah. Well, then in 1933 there was a provincial election, wasn't there? Yes. And the CCF ran. Did you have anything to do with that? I ran there.
You ran?
And deliberately chose a place where I couldn't be elected.
Where?
Couldn't be elected now, for that matter. That's point great. And my running partner was Frank Buck, who was a very good man on flowers and plants.
Well, here it says, September 2nd, 1934, CCF re-elect W.A. Pritchard. What did they re-elect you as?
Who said that?
This is the Vancouver Sun, I suppose.
Oh, Lord, if you're going to quote newspapers as authorities, just forget it.
Well, then there's a report.
I told you, we had three newspapers in this town when I was a member of the Trades and Labour Council. And they were all down on us. The World, the Sun, and the Province. And I called them the World, the Flesh, and the Devil. And the one that wanted to pick the latter name could do it on their own. But any one of their reporters could stand on a dime and write a $10 story. And there'd be no truth in it. Suddenly, you don't give me any
So you were never president of the BC CCS Club?
Not that I can recall. They may have looked upon it that. Oh! Reconstruction Society and the clubs. I probably functioned as chairman. I don't remember being officially elected president, but I do know that in the Okanagan they got the notion that I was the leader, whatever that is. Because there's another thing that I detest, and that's the question of leadership.
What's your attitude on that?
Hmm?
You don't think there should be leaders?
No, the labor movement suffers from leadership. That's it. What it suffers from is a lack of knowledge. Democracy is something that must come from the bottom, eh? Whatever. And it builds the top itself to do its bidding. Servants, not its dictators.
But you joined the CCS.
Oh, yes.
And you were at the Regina Convention.
Yes.
And were you on the CCS executive in British Columbia?
No.
No. Or the provincial council?
No.
But you ran as a CCF candidate?
Yeah. I guess they were short of material. But I picked the place where a millionaire could be elected. That's about all. You couldn't elect a CCF or NDP member now in Point Grey.
That's where
you South Vancouver near us, what is it called now? What do they call them now, a PC?
Yeah.
Progressive Conservative.
Yeah. Point Grey here, CCF candidate, that's yeah. You.
So you went in there as the second one out.
And the lady named Mrs. Steeves, there were three of us.
Mm-hmm. That was Dorothy Steeves, wasn't it?
Well,
yes.
All right. Now, we've got here an item, April the 27th, 1937. This is from the Vancouver province. Maybe we shouldn't believe them. But it says, new party names Price and Pritchard. Rowdyism at Connell meeting. BC constructives urge consolidation of BC public debt. Now, what?
Well, this is all ancient history.
Yeah.
And it happened. So happened there was some dispute in Victoria. Mr. Connell, the clergyman from Victoria, and a geologist, not a scientist, and he was the leader. Now, to open up this kind of wounds is to open awful wounds that people hear about. Not on any academic grounds, but on the ground that the party had elected Mr. O'Connell as the leader in the House. And I'm not in the House. Efforts were made to undermine him, get rid of him, and to promote Harry Winch, which they did. And it wasn't a positive fact on my part that I stayed with Mr. Connell. It's a matter of principle. To have a man elected and not then have him undermined by the people who elected him so that somebody else could be put in. Well, Harry Winch made it, and he became leader of the group. And he might have been premier at one time, except for the coalition. That's why I don't want to touch this kind of stuff, because I don't think much good comes out of it, but I'll tell you. Harold Winch announced, and I got that from the press, therefore I take it with reservations, that he was resigning his seat in the provincial house because of ill health. But he had a contract with the big liberal electrical firm in New Westminster as a subcontractor, and I think he was interested in that. But what happened, he evidently saw an opening in East Vancouver. He got nominated for East Vancouver, and anyone that carries their label can be elected there, CCF, NDP or whatever. So Jack Price was a member of the House, and he stayed with Connell. And I know just what Jack Price did in practical ways in helping people. He was a member of Street Elements Union. And I've been told Jack Price was a fool. Well, I've seen him go to the compensation board, and I've seen him go to other boards, put in a lot of time and do some practical work for someone that needed it. That's what you get from the province.
So apparently Connell was expelled from the CCS.
No. I think he resigned then. That when he started, he resigned.
And he formed this constructive party.
No, yeah, well, whatever. It would only last a short time. It was more of a gesture on my part. And I don't know.
So it wasn't really
I like Mr. O'Connell very much. He's quite a scholar. And he was everlastingly being browbeated and shouted down by the same people that you get today. I'm not going to get into it myself. I'm too old. But you are. You get them. Hmm?
Yes. And so you left the CCF too.
Oh, yes. I got out entirely. And then something happened that completely altered my life. But you remember the fellow that called yesterday? We talked about him. Larry? He wakes up and he said, this man wrote to me in Los Angeles. And he's after me again on sticking questions. Why this? Why did I do that? You know, what he was after was, why did I join the CCF in the first place? He said, I wasn't going to answer it. Because you can't answer that kind of a man. So the way I answered him was that when a person has lived a long life and has been aware of his development, he'll look back. As I am looking back as I write to you. And I look back and I can remember occasions when I might have done something of account that the circumstances called for and missed the opportunity. On the other hand, I can remember occasions where I jumped in and did something that had much better been left undone. Also, I can recall instances when the appropriate word would have been in order and I missed it, or the appropriate sentence. And other occasions when I opened my big mouth and realized afterwards that what I had said had been much better left unsaid. This is some years ago. I said, now approaching 80, that is what I have to say to you. And son, when you get to be my age and you are not able honestly to say that to yourself, you're either a liar or you need the attention of a psychiatrist. Now, when he called that day, that was in his crawl, see, yesterday.
He was
and I spoke to people in town here. They figured what I said was the proper answer. No one else knew what it was all about. But he knows what I said.
In a lot of the clippings that I saw about you, you seem to have been linked for some reason with Wallace LaFoe.
Yeah, of course.
Would you tell us?
He died this last year.
Yeah, would you tell us something about him?
Well, except that when I came to Vancouver in 1911, and arrived on the 19th of March, which was Friday morning. I went with my dad rolling down, and then I went to a meeting in the Empress Theatre, shortest meeting. And the man was giving a lecture there, and his name was LaFoe, Wallace W. LaFoe. I told Wally about it a few years back. He said, oh? I said, yes, weren't you there? He said, I don't know. He said, what was I speaking about? Well, I said, search your memory. What was your subject almost all the time? Oh, you were talking about gold. You know, how many ounces of gold of a certain degree of fineness was such and such? And yeah, that, oh yes, she said. You want to know something else, Wally? You know who your chairman was? He said, no. He was your brother, Frank. Oh yes, he spoke old Frank. Frank had died over time of talking to him. I saw him not last year, year before I went out. That was 1911. Now, I came out here, and I mentioned Frundles today. There was a fellow in South Burnaby, came from the Sioux line in Saskatchewan, and farmed down there. And he was a member of our party, and he wrote to me at the time when I was secretary. I had a lot of correspondence with him. And the boys here at that time, they would, you know, they'd get farm help, taking the crop. He would always send word, and they'd hit the freight, so they'd go down to Graves Farm, and better treated me probably than they would another farm. He came out here and went to the real estate. And one time I was visiting, and there's a bunch, he died. Well, they could have gone through the formality, you know, and so on, and it would have been looked after. He didn't want that. They didn't know what to do about it. Well, this Johnny Adams, that bookstore, says, Bill, he said, I don't know, what can you do? He said, well, would you take it over? His wife wanted someone to recite Excelsior because this was his favorite. Well, I said, all right. And I went out there. And they had a girl that sang. I said sang, but anyway, it was off pitch terribly, whatever it was she sang. And she talked to me. She went easy. I said, you know, Excelsior is set to music, not only as a solo, but as a duet, and as in four parts. Oh, she said, I wish I'd had a copy, I would have sung it for you. Well, I said, just as well, maybe, that you didn't. But that, and then old-timers came along. Now, there was a fellow there, and I learned afterwards that this man had fallen out of his own apple tree in South Burnaby and was injured, and so he's crippled. And he comes up there, doubled up, and he says, you don't remember me. Jimmy King. He says, my God, what a memory. I hadn't seen him for nearly 50 years then. And other people that have met. I can remember. Now, what is the gentleman's given name, the teacher, Mr. Young?
Charles Young.
Well, there he is. He asked me, if you remember, well, it was after the thing was over, yesterday, or the Tuesday, if I remember a meeting at Squamort in 1921, and I said, of course I do. It's the only one I ever held in Squamort. You've no chance to forget that again. Well, then he quoted something I'd said, and it brought it to mind. But when that was over, and he came to me, he said, do you remember that meeting that a young fellow sitting on the aisle? Not particularly. I said, it was a COVID meeting. And he smiled. I said, you mean that was you? He said, yes. Well, I said, no wonder that I didn't recognize you if you were just a young fellow. You didn't have a beard then. Well, at that same meeting, there was an old fellow. Not then, he wasn't old, named Holiday, Dan Holiday. And I'd spoken to him then. And at the reception they gave me in Victoria at the time of the celebration of Winnipeg strike, and a reception there, up comes this old man. And I said, hey, after all these years, a new Holiday? He said, yes. Well, are you at the meeting in Squamort? He said, yeah, this is how I was going to talk to you about it. I don't remember last names very well now. I've got to put them with two attached, didn't I?
Well, did you know Lefroy at the time of the general strike?
Yes, he was thought about his speech. And they turned round pointing to the foe. We'll see to it, young man, through the bar of BC, that you don't get any further. It's Randy.
But
he worked with McMurray, and he worked with McMurray afterwards.
And he was a member of the Socialist Party?
Yes. He stayed in Winnipeg,
yeah,
after the preliminary hearing,
yeah,
helping McMurray in the preparation of the speech.
He was also, as I understand, of course you wouldn't know because you were in jail then, but he was the secretary of the Winnipeg Defense Committee.
Yes.
That put out the book.
Yes.
And organized the defense.
Yes, he did that. And then he took a trip to Russia.
Yes.
And I think he wrote a brochure about Winnipeg, London, and Moscow.
A study in Bolshevism.
Yes. He probably learned something.
And he also accompanied Truman.
Yes.
To take the case to the Privy Council. Yes.
And he speaks of that in the book.
Yes. Yes.
The remarkable thing that Wally came back with was the opinion expressed, and I think it was by Carlson. Either Carlson or Birkenhead. And the opinion was the effect that these men were treasonable. This is from the man that organized the shipping of military goods and military forces into Ulster in the early days.
To crush the Easter uprising.
Huh?
To crush the Irish uprising.
They were going to maintain Ulster. Anyway,
yeah.
He was acting against the British Crown.
Oh, he was acting against the British Crown?
Of course.
Oh, I see. And now he was acting for the British Crown?
No.
Well, when he was the head of the Privy Council.
Oh, yeah, that's afterwards. Just
yeah.
After he pulled this stuff on...
Yeah.
On
with Lord Birkenhead.
Was it Birkenhead?
Yes.
Now, here's another gentleman. It could have been Carlson, but because Birkenhead was with him anyway. And Birkenhead gets his name because he was a member. Birkenhead. It's across the river from Liverpool.
His name was Smith.
Yes. His name was not only Smith, and it wasn't Mikey, it was. And his name was Frederick E. Smith. And he was known in Lancashire in those days in politics as Frocky Freddy. Here's another chap. You see, law and order means to these people what suits them, as it does to the Nixon forces.
So this Wallace LaFoe was a member of the Socialist Party of Canada in British Columbia,
yes,
as you were.
Wallace LaFoe joined the Socialist Party of Canada in Revelstoke in 1903. And he showed me a copy of the first volume of Marx in his writing, his beautiful writing there. Now, down in Matsatlan, there's a fellow named Bennett. He's dead now. And he was 96 when he died. But this was another Bennett, also named William. William J. This was a rapporteur of the First War in this old man. A linguist. Came from Staffordshire. Knew Eleanor Marx and was in Spain when Ferrer was shot for his educational work. And he told me that he was the one that introduced LaFoe to the movement. And very possibly so. He was then in Revelstoke. Then he became editor of the Burnley Ledger, one of the best Labour papers, because it was well edited and well written. But he goes down to Matsatlan and teaches navigation in the Polytechnic and languages. And 2 years in succession, selected as the man of the year, for Mexico. That's all his medals. I should have gone to Matsatlan. He wanted me to go down there anyway. He was a sturdy old guy. I could tell you stories. To retell them, if I told them, then there would be no punchline and no laugh. But the way he could tell them stories was wonderful. That twice. I met him twice in Los Angeles, and once in San Francisco. When the night before, he'd been out with my friend Jack McDonald, you know, this cop around the town. And Jack, having to add on in town that next day, he said, "Bill, I'm Jack Bennett's in town, and we'll take you out tonight." So he phoned, and he said, "I want to see Bill, I'm not going out again tonight." He's very disturbed, 93 about that time. The biggest. He went on a boat to come up here to Vancouver, and he found it. And some lives were lost, and he was then way in his 80s. And he swam 3/4 of a mile ashore.
Now, somebody the other day gave this estimation of Wallace Lefaux, that he was Canada's greatest Marxist. Do you think so?
I don't like to term that. You see, they pick on a man and they hang a label on it. Of course, the capitalist press gave Bill Fritz the credit of being Canada's greatest orator. And it took the wreath from Bennett and handed it to me. And I don't like to be considered the successor of William Bedford Bennett.
Richard.
Yes. Oh. No, I'll tell you, though, up at the university you visited yesterday,
They
have a bookshop. And that bookshop, for many years, was run by a man named Morgan, whose trade was that of a plumber. And became plumbing inspector in Vancouver, and then sanitary inspector chief. And when he was through with that, then he went to the university. And he wrote a thesis himself. I don't know what he did that. It was silly. What he wanted to do, and did, was to translate a short book of Arthur Labriola, the son of Professor Labriola, who was the tutor of Croce. He wanted to translate that into Italian, and he taught himself Italian, and he was a good French scholar, so much so that when he joined the Masons, he went through the Masonic ritual in Italian. Italian speaking. This was Morgan. Now, in economics, I would put him top. He piloted the whole crowd of kids out of UBC writing their thesis on economics. One, a brilliant boy, also named Morgan. He came to see me. Did come up to my place, Capitol Hill, there, and get questions. So I remember these old timers. And Lefaux. But you see, there were others older than Jack Bennett, for instance. E.G. McKenzie. And when this is also seems to me humorous. The Lefaux's father was a member of or chairman of the board of the London Port Authority. And he had an office of some kind in Revelstoke. And a Scot by the name of McKenzie. He called Matt, sometimes the poor Scotchman. He wrote him about it. He kind of looks after this office called Lefaux. It was a double office on the other side. The entrance in the middle, on the other side, was another fellow that had some kind of business named Coursier. And the French Canadian loggers would come down out of the hills into town looking around, where should they go? And they see these two names. This is what Bill Bennett could tell you is the Mickey Hewers, Lefaux and Coursier. They go into it. When they got there, they found that the only guy inside there was a Scotsman named McKenzie. Educated in Edinburgh, born in India.
Lefaux himself was an Englishman.
Oh, yes. London. But, McKenzie must have had quite a life. He was up away in the Peace River country and the Great Slave Lake before anybody ever bothered about him. Very few. I remember him telling my dad then about Pitchblende. He said, "Jim, here's something that's going to be a great consequence years to come." And that's where I got my Philip, from all the fellows, from Mackenzie and from Harrington, I was close to him in age, and I was right on his heels in study, I guess. They said I developed rapidly, I don't know. But I always liked Wally.
He studied Marxism too.
Oh, yes.
He was an alderman in Red Oak.
The Paul?
Yeah.
He was.
And
that's something I didn't know. Oh, well, because the province took my letter and pitched it and made it. And my idea was, at that time, with the towns and the municipalities being in such distress, on the government, the provincial government might do it, that they all turn in their bonds with issue new ones. I guaranteed it. And so that if the result would have been, I forget the scheme now, it's so complicated, that, for instance, a town that was better situated would then be compelled in this levelling process to assist the town that could not meet that. Just as you can send a letter to next door neighbour and you send one to Quebec for the same price. The long haul is equal to the short one. It was to flatten the thing out. Because there were municipalities that weren't bothering the government. Oak Bay, for instance, in Victoria, why should they bother the government? Why should Point Grey? Except at that time, Point Grey was part of the city of Vancouver. But hadn't been for a short time. Changed its place. But there's the trick. It's to shove the burden onto whatever shoulders will take it. And in this case, as I told them, that my estimation of the constitutional structure was municipal, provincial, dominion in Canada. Because the responsibilities and duties that devolve on a municipality come from the provincial authority by the charter. And the municipality is the mudstill of this constitutional structure. And if you don't pay attention to the mudstills, gentlemen, the building will fall. They'll let it fall.
Do you think they just left the municipality? Do you think they ignored you on purpose, or they were just badly managed?
I don't know. They didn't ignore me. They weren't allowed to.
Yes, but how could they not send the money for so long?
Oh, now, now you're dealing with authoritarian ignorance, prejudice. Why don't they see? They don't want to see.
Is it the same thing that's happening also between the province and the dominion?
Well, you run your head now into the politicians of the moment. You'll find out how many things they don't want to see. What has been missed here is something in between.
Yeah.
Before we went to Victoria and before I asked that the payment not be made on, they laid out the whole situation in Burnaby. We gave a balance sheet. We showed what we had here, what we had there, and then laid down what we proposed to do with what we had. Counting, of course, on what was coming to us from the two governments. And we took that to the Royal Bank of Canada, in Vancouver here, corner of Hastings and Granville, I guess it is. And we laid that before the manager. Quite a conversation. He said, excellent. We will stand behind it. Mm-hmm. Now we had our banker going to stand behind our scheme to carry on the municipal work. He said, of course, you'll have to get provincial approval. Mm-hmm. Well, there you are. Well, we went to get the approval. And we didn't get that.
It was a great case of game they were playing in the depression. Of passing the buck.
Passing the buck. Yeah, right. No one would take
the buck. Oh, they probably want to know if it was prejudice. I could say they didn't like me. And there were those who wanted to get my scalp. And baby, without trying to be boastful, what they got was what was under my scalp. And I give it to them yet, but they're not around to listen.
Without survive them all.
Yeah.
Without survive them all.
Yeah.
Well,
I suppose if there's any purpose in it, it's long life, it's just a little long time. Yeah, if you can. Well, there's that old story.